Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. My guest today is the next University of Tulsa presidential lecturer, playwright and screenwriter Tony Kushner, Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright of Angels in America, and the Oscar-nominated screenwriter for Steven Spielberg's films Munich and Lincoln. Kushner's best-known work, of course, is the play Angels in America, a seven-hour epic in two parts, Millennium Approaches and Perestroika, which details life during the AIDS epidemics of the 1980s, which many critics refer to as one of the most important pieces of theater in the last half of the 20th century. He later adapted that work for a miniseries on HBO, which was directed by Mike Nichols. Kushner's other best-known work includes the screenplays of the films Munich, a nuanced view of the Israeli Olympic massacre, and Lincoln, which focused on the last 4 months of the president's life and the passage of the 13th Amendment abolishing slavery. But Kushner has always experimented in his writing. He wrote the book for the hit musical Carolina Change with composer Janine Tesori. They're currently at work on a full-length opera. He's also adapted classic works by Bertolt Brecht and other classic playwrights. In our conversation, he gives us a little insight into what his next experiment in writing may be. This year, he was awarded the National Medal of the Arts by President Obama to add to his list of honors and awards. He'll be speaking tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center as a part of the University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture Series, and he joins us today by phone here on Studio Tulsa. Tony Kushner, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks. It's nice to talk to you.
One of the things I've found most interesting about your work, you're always exploring new art forms, whether it's screenplays, as it's been in the last decade with Munich and Lincoln, opera librettos, musical stories, traditional plays. Now, one thing you haven't done, I mean, you've written essays, but as far as short stories or novels, you've never done that, and I think from reading your speeches and interviews and the like, that doesn't appeal to you, that whole idea of being the solo writer that doesn't have some sort of collaborative feedback at some point in the process. I would assume that a lot of your writing is, again, solo, putting your thoughts down on paper, but at some point you have this collaboration that helps shape your characters, shape your ideas. Is that a fair assessment?
I love reading novels. I've never been a great short story reader. I'm beginning to appreciate the form more the older I get, I think. But certainly I'm a novel reader. I've just never thought in terms of writing novels or stories that would occur to me in a way that seems to me to be particularly novelistic. It's not an ambition of mine to do it. I think it's a very different form than a play. I think there's a reason why, for the most part, playwrights who've attempted to write novels haven't really succeeded, and vice versa. I think it's sort of almost axiomatic that novelists who write plays are going to have a hard time. So it's something that I can't really imagine that I'll ever be tempted to do. I think I would like to write, possibly at some point, a longer nonfiction piece, a book. Well, I wrote one book about Maurice Sendak, and I might want to try biography or a study of another writer, possibly Bertolt Brecht, who is a very important writer for me.
How does Bertolt Brecht inform your own work?
If you're a person who's interested in politics and interested in theater, Brecht is kind of an unavoidable figure, and in a way, although there are things that I used to completely agree with Brecht about and now I'm not so sure, he's an essential figure in terms of understanding both the way that theater can be a political force and the way that theater can treat politics, but also just if you're interested in theater at all. I mean, I don't think there's any playwright who's thought more deeply about the nature of the theatrical experience and the very particular effect it has on an audience than Brecht. He's the only playwright, really, in world history, I think, who can be said to have generated a serious body of critical writing alongside an important body of dramatic writing. And he was also one of the great German-language poets of the 20th century. I mean, along with Rilke, I think you'd have to say that he was the greatest. It's an overwhelmingly important body of work, and I've been reading his stuff and thinking about his stuff, and I've done two translations of his plays, Mother Courage and Good Person of Szechuan, and he is an inescapable and essential figure for me, And interestingly, I mean, I think there are lots of reasons for this, his work and who himself is very, very much misunderstood. There's a really questionable large biography by John Fuegi about him that I think ultimately sort of grotesquely distorts who he was and what his work was about, and a lot of misunderstanding of what he was writing about theoretically. So I think there's a need for a new consideration of him. Whether or not I'll ever have the time to do it, I don't know, but it's something that I always think about. It may be something that doesn't happen, but, you know, maybe I'll wind up writing a play about him instead. We'll see.
There you go. I was intrigued by something you said earlier at the very beginning. You said, you know, I used to completely agree with Brecht on a lot of things, and now I'm having second thoughts. Where's an area where you're having second thoughts?
I don't know that there's second thoughts. I mean, I've said this a lot in recent years. I feel both uncertain about the kind of, when we talk about the political effectivity of theater, I have some questions about whether or not theater has the kind of direct force that is really required for a person who wants to exercise political agency. It's not activism by another means. I'm more and more convinced of that. Theater is something else, and it can have a political force, and even in some rare instances, a sort of a direct, almost measurable political impact. But for the most part, I think plays that last and plays that really are seen as valuable are working on a level that isn't sort of propagandistic or... I mean, I have nothing against propaganda, and really good propaganda is very hard to do. But I think that art in general and in my field being theater, theater in particular, there is a power in art that is indirect and not finally directable. You can't be sure what you're releasing into the world when you create a work of art, and it has its particular dangers as well as exciting possibilities. And I think that the older I get and the more I make theater, the more I come to feel that that's really the case. And, you know, Brecht lived in a time of enormous political crisis, you know, the build-up to and through the Second World War and then the most intense early years of the Cold War. And I think that he had a particular sense of theater as being direct participation in political struggle. I don't reject that, but I don't think that I have a particular skill at writing theater like that, and the stuff that I really love that Brecht wrote is not work that I think works particularly well as agitprop. I think that he's a writer of enormous complexity and depth and subtlety and strangeness. And a play like Mother Courage, you know, which is thought of as being like this kind of anti-war play, is not actually an anti-war play in the ordinary sense. I got into an argument years ago with a British journalist who was going on and on and on about how disgusting it was that Brecht would write an anti-war play at the beginning of World War II. And I had to point out that in Mother Courage, the most important moral act in the entire play is waking up a town so that it can fight to defend itself. It's not a pacifist play at all. So, you know, I think that's the way in which I suspect that Brecht might be unhappy with me if he read my stuff and heard me talking. I don't know.
Well, I think, I mean, while it's not propaganda in any sort of sense, or agitprop, as you mentioned, but Angels in America does have that direct force of political eye-opening or awakening, if you will, at its best. It has that power that you're talking about. Maybe more so with the adaptation for mass, you know, the television adaptation, just because more people see it. And maybe that's where it is theater doesn't reach as many people as it used to.
Well, maybe that's true. Maybe that's not true. I don't really know. I mean, you know, there's an awful lot of theater being done. I mean, it's certainly the case that, you know, we don't have events like Death of a Salesman, where, you know, at the point that Miller wrote the play and that it opened, theater still was hanging on kind of to its cultural primacy. So an important new American play was seen as a sort of a major event that everybody who was interested in culture had to participate in. Film has, to a certain extent, and television also, have supplanted theater in that regard. But back in the day when Arthur Miller was writing, there wasn't a regional theater movement with, you know, serious and good theaters in many, 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 many cities in the United States. So there's more access, absolutely, to professional theater around the country now than there ever was before. And consequently, I'm not sure that we see less theater that reaches fewer people. You know, I think the question of a mass audience aside, what Mike did with the film and what I've certainly seen other people do in the United States and elsewhere with the play is make a sort of a, you know, a good movie out of it or a good play. And I think that at the, especially at the time that it was first produced, Angels had a, you know, very, very direct relationship to a kind of a coming to awareness of the extent and the horror of the AIDS crisis. And, you know, I think it was a offered a possibility for kind of public mourning. And also because it was a very famous play and won all these awards, and was on Broadway and national tour and everything, and then on television with the Emmys and all, a lot of people who were gay or lesbian showed it to their parents, and there was part of people coming out. And I mean, all that's great, and I really love that, and I'm very proud of that. And it means a lot to me when people come up and tell me things like that. But if the play's going to last, and it seems to be doing pretty well in that regard, it's well over 20 years old now and still being done, it's going to last because it's got something in it that's more than just an opportunity to declare your allegiance to a political cause, no matter how worthy that cause is. I mean, I think that, you know, LGBT enfranchisement is an enormously worthy cause, and, you know, and not demonizing people with a serious illness is it's a very laudable thing to refuse to do that. But I think if all Angels was a sort of an appeal for those sort of, you know, for that kind of behavior, I don't think that it would last all that long. I think it would start to feel very dated. And it's, I can't imagine why, you know, why does, for example, I'm not comparing the plays, but why do we watch A Doll's House
right,
long after the, you know, feminist revolution, you know, completely transformed the role of women, the place of women in society and, you know, certainly the industrialized world, so that what Nora is going through is virtually, and, you know, it's very few women in Europe, certainly, or America, live lives exactly like that, with that those few options. And yet the play doesn't feel dated in any way, because the play is about a deep internal human process of liberation that human beings on a political level, on a psychological, emotional, developmental level, go through over and over again. And we'll always watch Doll's House because of the, you know, extraordinary way that it dramatizes that struggle. And you know, so I think that it's, you know, there's a, for a play to be really good as a play, as opposed to opportune in a particular historical moment when it can galvanize opinion and sort of contribute to a political struggle, if the play's really going to last, I think it has to go after deeper, more complicated things. I mean, I've said this many times, I'll probably say it when I'm in Tulsa again. I really, in a way, believe the Shakespeare model, that it's a, you know, it's like dreaming. You are given visions of things that in your waking life you can't commensurate, you can't absorb, you can't process, and you watch them during your dreaming life because you're inert and unlikely to do any damage to yourself while you're thinking about these things. But the deal that the unconscious makes with the dreamer is that you have the choice of not remembering the dream, or misremembering it, or remembering it and then pushing it away. there's no demand before you watch it that you're going to act on it or even understand it. And I think that's what makes it possible for you to permit the dreaming or to buy a ticket to a play, is that you can take it or leave it after you've watched it. And I think that's part of what I mean by an indirect power. It can be an enormous force. It can change a lot in people's lives. But ultimately, we put it out there, and then the audience is either going to hear it or not hear it, act on it or not act on it, understand it however they choose to understand it.
My guest today is Tony Kushner, the Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright, a two-time Oscar-nominated screenwriter. Recently won the National Medal of the Arts. He is the University of Tulsa's presidential lecturer tomorrow night at the Reynolds Center, and he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. I think it was a speech you gave to a writers group that was republished.
Whiting Writers Award.
Yeah, the Whiting Writers Award. And it was interesting, and you've spoke frequently about your tendency to procrastinate and the difficulty it is in sitting down and writing. And you wrote that you were utterly unsuited to the task of telling how to live a happy, disciplined writer's life, slow reader, undisciplined and unhappy writing and expect to be until the writing stops. And you say you find a remarkable number of things to do in a day, much more compelling than writing, yet you continue to write. And can you give us a sense of, if that is true, the satisfaction you get from creating incredible characters, telling incredible stories through your media?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I think that when you are in the process of writing, once you get past the, or I shouldn't say you, when I get past the terror of picking up the pen and starting again every day, and I'm deep in it, it is, of course, enormously gratifying. And you're in conversation with yourself in a very, very deep way, and because it's being written down in a kind of permanent way, you're constantly leaving yourself all sorts of information that's there in black and white, which is different than a fleeting thought or a conversation with yourself that's just happening entirely inside your head. You're leaving sort of forensic evidence of how complicated and good and, you know, dreadful a person you are on the page. And the business of sort of reading that evidence and becoming a scientist and figuring out what it is you're trying to tell yourself and then ultimately tell an audience is challenging and in a kind of a puzzle-solving way, thrilling. But, you know, the any number of factors, a fear of failure, a fear of mortality, I think. I mean, you know, I noticed that when I'm working a lot right now, I'm having to write a lot fairly quickly for a deadline reason, and I'm noticing, you know, as I've noticed many times in the past, that when you're not working, when you're not writing, when you're doing other things, time moves more slowly. The minute you sit down and engage in writing, and I'm sure this is true of anybody who engages in any kind of, like, really intense, focused activity, you look up and 3 hours have gone by. And I would imagine on some level, I think to myself, my God, if I write, like, five more plays, I'll be dead. I mean, you know, and it will, time will have shot by, you know, very, very quickly. You can really convince yourself, fool yourself, that you're actually going to beat the clock, ultimately, that you're going to beat time and the sort of scary place that it's inexorably leading you to, if you just, you know, refuse to do those things that seem to make it pass more rapidly. And, of course, that's an illusion. I mean, you know, no matter how much you slow it down, you're not going to be able to slow it down all that much, and you're going to wind up in the same place whether you've written or not. And
so you might as well write.
You might as well write, and also, you know, it's how I make my living. I'm not, you know, independently wealthy, and so it's never been I've always been a little bit worried that if I actually didn't have to write for a living, would I write anything at all? But I hope so. I hope I would. I mean, I think it's, I'm happy to have finished writing if I like what I've written. And I actually do enjoy the process of it. It's always the business of forcing yourself back to the desk.
Yeah.
And starting again.
Now, you've often said that you really are a deadline writer. The deadline is the motivating force in many cases to get the work done. I would think, especially in a collaborative field as playwriting, screenwriting, there are a lot of people waiting on what you're going to come
there
up.
There are. You know, I mean, when I say that deadlines motivate me to write, I mean, unfortunately, a lot of times there's some part of me that thinks, okay, the deadline is about to arrive. As soon as it does, I'll start. I don't quite get the idea that I'm supposed to be finished by then. It's, you know, I don't know. I mean, it's very helpful to have a feeling that somebody is, I mean, Brecht wrote about this very movingly, that when he went into exile and he sort of was without his public. I mean, he wasn't, you know, he was still very, very well known, but in Germany he was, you know, immensely significant writer before he fled in 1933. I mean, he was one of the first German writers who had to leave because he was very famous. He was on the top of the SS hit list. So he had to leave instantly. And he said it's very hard when nobody is waiting for your writing to keep writing. It's very hard to just do it. And I think that's the playwright speaking. I mean, I think that there are other forms of writing. You know, nobody ever got a chance to see what Emily Dickinson, almost no one got to see what Emily Dickinson was writing, and yet she wrote. But toiling in obscurity without an audience, without a public, is I think, almost impossible for a playwright to do. So it's helpful to know that your audience or your actors or Steven Spielberg or a film studio is waiting for you to deliver. And also, if you don't want to get fired, you know, you better be there with the goods. And, you know, I mean, I talk a lot about procrastination. I've never actually not delivered something that I was supposed to deliver. I know how to manage the trick of cutting it close, but also being, you know, reliable enough that people still want to hire me. I feel like I should add that before I destroy my entire career in the course of this interview by sounding completely impossible to work with.
Well, speaking of what you're working on now, are you a play, screenplay? I guess the opera libretto continues, but that's still a few years away, it sounds like, fleshing out the one act.
Yeah, I mean, I have to finish the libretto, the second act of the libretto, very soon, so I'm working on that, working on a couple of screenplays. I'm working on the idea for an HBO television series or long-term serial TV thing. I don't know exactly.
Now, that is something you haven't done yet. Is that attractive?
Well, yeah, I mean, in a way, I did, because Angel.
Well, Angel's, you know, yeah.
Mike did it. It was a six-hour miniseries. And it's interesting. It's when you talk to television people who, when I talk to television people about it, television writers who like what we did, they really think of it not as a play, but as a miniseries. But yeah, I mean, I love television. I watch much more television probably than I should. And you know, we're in the, I mean, it's becoming a cliche to say this, but it's really true. I mean, we're in the middle of, certainly one of the most extraordinary, if not the most extraordinary, moment, in the history of the medium. I mean, this is since the, arrival of David Chase and the Sopranos, the form has changed completely, and some of the most exciting and deep and complex and profound work is happening on television. Breaking Bad and Mad Men and The Wire. I mean, these are really, you know, I think serious and significant works of art. And certainly The Sopranos, I think, mm-hmm. absolutely was and was sort of the seminal thing. So, you know, since everything I write is very long, and I tend to think in my brain constructs dramatic arcs, I think, that are almost always, you know, about an hour in length. I think in terms of, like, episodes, I think. And it feels like it's a medium that I should try, so I'm trying it. It's also, interestingly, I'm beginning to understand, you know, unlike film, which really is a director's medium, television is still the model is still that, you know, the writer runs it.
Yeah, the writer does. In fact, oftentimes the writer's the producer. You bet. Yeah.
Well, the showrunner, this figure that it's taken me a while to kind of wrap my mind around what it is, but it's you know, directors are very important, and more serious directors are getting interested in working on television, I think, because the scripts are getting so exciting and the stories. But the construction of the narrative in the writer's room and with the head writer sort of supervising and then, you know, sort of hiring the personnel, it's a little bit more like theater in that regard. The writer has a kind of primacy in television that is somewhat reminiscent of the playwright's primacy in theater, and you know, very different from film, where unless you're directing your own screenplay, you're very much working for a director.
And I assume in Steven Spielberg, you found somebody that you can have that sort of working relationship with, even though it is Steven's film at the end of the day.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, it's really great if you're collaborating with somebody. I think it always helps in a way. When I write a musical or an opera with Janine, I can't write music. So it helps that, you know, what she's doing and what I'm doing are not, neither of us has the option to do what the other is doing. And I could no more direct a film than I could fly a jet airplane. I barely understand. I'm getting a little bit clearer about the machinery of it, but it's just not an ambition of mine to do it. And Steven is, you know, obviously one of the great film directors of all time and, you know, a kind of narrative genius. And, So a really wonderful guy and somebody who is very respectful of writers and excited by writing. So I've just had a fantastic time working with him.
Well, the idea of maybe a 2 or 3, 4 seasons limited series on television is very intriguing. I hope we see that someday soon. Tony Kushner, it's a pleasure to speak with you. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. It's really lovely to talk to you.
Pulitzer Prize and Tony Award-winning playwright and Oscar-nominated screenwriter Tony Kushner speaking with us here on Studio Tulsa. He'll be the guest of the next University of Tulsa Presidential Lecture, sponsored by the Darcy O'Brien Chair, tomorrow evening at 7:30 at the Reynolds Center on the University of Tulsa campus. That presentation is free and open to the public. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests or commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. If you missed one of our recent programs or missed part of today's programs, you can listen online anytime at publicradiotulsa.org. Just search for Studio Tulsa. You can look through our archives or find the latest program. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.